At my blog, I describe myself as a reluctant dispensationalist. That name was given to me by a friend after we were discussing some of my issues with traditional dispensationalism. Now, I don't believe, by the way, that progressive dispensationalism is really dispensational at all. Not any more than Reformed theology, covenant theology is dispensational. If you look at, for example, the systematic theology of Charles Hodge or that of Louis Berkhof, they speak of dispensations. And many covenant theologians have no problem in talking about dispensations, meaning epochs. Usually they have four, although Willem van Gemeren has 12 epochs or dispensations. Progressive dispensationalists really are closer in their use of dispensation to the covenant theologians. They might want to argue against that, but really I don't see very much difference in the outcome of the two systems. There's much more to say about progressive dispensationalism, and I'm not going to say it here. Let's return to traditional dispensationalism. Now, by that, I'm just using that as an umbrella term to describe the basic outline of or lineaments of dispensationalism from the late 1900s till, say, the 1960s or 1970s. Although many people, of course, still espouse that view today. That would take in people like James Hall Brooks, C.I. Schofield, Louis Sperry Schaeffer, John Walvoord, Charles Ryrie, and others like Eric Sauer, René Pesch, Graham Scroggie, Alva McLean, John Whitcomb, and many others. These men and others, I think, have done some really outstanding work as interpreters of the Word of God, and I certainly do not want to denigrate or cast any kind of aspersions on their work in this lecture. But the lecture is entitled Dispensationalism or Biblical Covenantalism. What this lecture is all about is really whether dispensationalists have not shot themselves in the foot by identifying themselves as dispensationalists, calling themselves something that actually restricts their theological endeavors. They've kind of hogtied themselves, I believe. And I think a more full-orbed way of looking at this position is through the biblical covenants and not through the dispensations or divine economies. Now, someone might say, well, haven't you read someone like J. Dwight Pentecost or others who say that we are the real covenant theologians, just the Reform guys got there first? Yes, I've read those comments and I've heard those comments. But the problem is, when you look at the way dispensationalists define themselves and define their system, they really are not covenant theologians. They have a better place for the biblical covenants than covenant theologians do, because covenant theologians have very little room for the biblical covenants. But as far as doing anything with the biblical covenants, other than recognizing them, dispensationalists have got a long way to go. And the question that I asked myself some years ago was, why haven't they done the work? And my feeling is that it has quite a lot to do with the self-understanding of dispensationalists. And that self-understanding begins with the problem of definition, as most things do. When you turn to their works, you will see that they define themselves by dispensations and not by the covenants. In fact, sadly, you will find in the works of nearly every main dispensationalist, when they come to define the system, they do not have a place for the biblical covenants. Not in their definitions, not in their self-understandings. Now, they do in their system. But their definition, you see, is what fills out their self-understanding. And because of that, the work on the biblical covenants done by traditional dispensationalists has been quite restrictive and has not had a huge impact on the way that they fill out their system. Now, let me prove this by providing some definitions by some well-known dispensationalists. This first one is by Robert Leitner, and in his Handbook of Evangelical Theology, page 240, in a footnote, he writes, dispensationalism is, quote, that system of theology which sees the Bible as the unfolding of the distinguishable economies in the outworking of God's purpose, and which sees the ultimate purpose of God to bring glory to himself in all his relations with all his creatures, end quote. Well, you see, there's no place there for the biblical covenants. According to Leitner's definition, dispensationalism is about the unfolding of the distinguishable economies, or dispensations, those stewardships under which people down through biblical history had been placed under by God at certain times of history. Nothing here about the covenants. What is important is the dispensations, you see. Let's look at another definition. This one is by Reynolds Showers in his book There Really Is a Difference, page 27. He defines dispensationalism as, quote, a system of theology which attempts to develop the Bible's philosophy of history on the basis of the sovereign rule of God. It represents the whole of Scripture and history as being covered by several dispensations of God's rule, end quote. Again, can you see there's no room there in that definition for the biblical covenants? Now, that means that dispensationalists, when they are asked to identify what they are, what they are doing, and what their system is all about, they don't think of the covenants. They think of dispensations. And it's that thinking which I think is the problem. Let me give you another one. This is by Stanley Toussaint in his article, A Biblical Defense of Dispensationalism, in the book Walvoord, A Tribute, pages 82 and 83. Dispensationalism, Toussaint writes, simply results from an investigation into the progress of God's plan as revealed in the Scriptures. It recognizes various administrations or economies in this outworking of God's plan in history. So again, where's the emphasis? The emphasis is on the dispensations, not on the covenants. One more. This is Paul Benware in his book Understanding End Times Prophecy, Revised and Expanded Edition, page 374. According to Benware, dispensationalism is, quote, a theological system that approaches the Scriptures by seeing distinguishable stewardships of man under the authority of God. It is God who reveals his purposes to man and delegates responsibilities to him, end quote. So I hope you're getting the point. Dispensationalists do not put the onus on the biblical covenants. They put the onus on the so-called distinguishable stewardships of man under the authority of God. Now, how distinguishable are these stewardships? That's a question that we need to answer. Another question that we need to answer is, how theologically helpful or profitable is it to define your system by these dispensations? Now, of course, somebody can say, well, look, dummy, of course a dispensationalist is going to define himself by dispensations. I mean, what's wrong with that? Well, the problem is, you see, earlier writers often didn't define themselves as dispensationalists. They didn't call themselves that. They called themselves premillennialists or some other less restrictive term. But when especially American prophetic writers started to call themselves dispensationalists, the question has to be asked, why did they use that name? Why did they choose the name dispensationalist? After all, if they thought the biblical covenants were more important than the dispensations, they should have put the onus on the covenants. and included that in their definitions. They haven't done that. I think a recent dispensationalist who does speak about the covenants in his definition is Michael Vlach. But Michael Vlach, along with most dispensationalists, only believes that dispensationalism has something to say in the areas of ecclesiology, the doctrine of the church, and eschatology, the doctrine of the end times. Some people, particularly of the free grace movement, would add soteriology, the doctrine of salvation, to that list. But most of them would not say that dispensationalism has something to say in all areas of systematic theology. And again, I ask, why is that? How can these people, and I've read in several of the definitions that they think that dispensationalism is a system of theology? Well, if it's a system of theology, how come it's actually not a system? How come it is tagged on to another system, usually Reformed theology, just in those areas of ecclesiology and eschatology? You see, even though they say that it's a system of theology, it really isn't a system of theology. It is just a couple of corpora out of a system of theology, or added to a system of theology already in place. And that is another problem with dispensationalism. And I ask myself, well, why do they do this? Why do they have this understanding of themselves, which is so restrictive? First of all, they restrict themselves to divine economies, and then they restrict themselves to just speaking about two or three corpora of the seven or eight corpora of systematic theology. Why do they do that? And my answer is, because dispensations are not very theologically productive. Dispensations don't tell you very much about the doctrine of God, or the doctrine of Christ, or the doctrine of the Holy Spirit, or a number of other doctrines. They don't tell you much about the biblical worldview. The fact of the matter is that one is hard-pressed to find any dispensationalist who wholeheartedly advocates a full-orbed dispensationalist approach to every area of systematic theology. Further, dispensationalist works in biblical theology, because they are tied to trying to figure out the dispensations, don't tend to be really tremendously helpful. Now, Eugene Merrill has recently written a very good Old Testament theology called Everlasting Dominion, where he puts a lot of emphasis on the biblical covenants. And that's what makes his treatment so interesting and so theologically productive. But that's not the case with most attempts by dispensationalists at that discipline. Not that there have been very many. What actually can you do with a dispensation, with a divine economy, a stewardship under which people are placed by God for a certain period of time? What actually can you do with that theologically? Can you create a full-orbed systematic theology from that platform? Can you create the biblical worldview from that platform? I would say certainly not. You can't do that. And the reason is that these divine economies are mostly descriptive of things that happened in the past, or of things that will happen in the future. But there is no prescriptive work that you can do with them. Just take our own dispensation, if you will, the so-called dispensation of grace. Okay, so we have a dispensation in which the responsibility or stewardship is to accept the gift of righteousness that is offered to us in the gospel. Okay? So once we've done that, what else can we do with this self-restrictive definition of dispensation? You see, there's nothing in the idea of a divine administration or economy that you can do any work with. All you can do is describe a few things. And this brings us to the next problem. And that is, what are the things that you're describing? I've just called our dispensation the dispensation of grace, because that is usually what it's called. Some people call it the dispensation of the church, which I think would be a better name for it. But the dispensation of grace, what does the word grace mean in that definition? Well, actually, what it means is the Pauline gospel. After all dispensationalists believe that people in every dispensation are saved by grace, through faith. Therefore, calling our dispensation a dispensation of grace doesn't really say very much about what distinguishes this dispensation. And you look at the other names of the dispensations. Let's say that we take the usual seven. The first dispensation is called the dispensation of innocence. That, of course, is in Eden before the fall. Adam and Eve were innocent. They were in a state of innocence before they fell. The word innocence there describes their moral character. They weren't positively holy or righteous. In other words, they weren't sinless. They did not have the attribute of sinlessness. They only had the characteristic of not having sinned. Fine. So, if it's the dispensation of innocence, what does that tell us? That they were to continue being innocent? That doesn't really do very much. You can't do any systematic theology. You can't really do much biblical theology with that definition. Now, the next one is the dispensation of conscience. Now, does that mean that Adam and Eve, before the fall, didn't have a conscience? If you're saying that, then you would have to believe that the conscience is something that is given to man only when he's fallen. I'm not sure that you can say that. Maybe that's true, but I'm not sure that definitions of the conscience, which are always difficult anyway, should be boiled down to a sense of right and wrong. But you see, conscience is not the same thing as innocence, is it? And you could say that whereas before Adam and Eve were innocent, in other words, they didn't know right and wrong, now they are not innocent, they have consciences, and therefore they do know right from wrong, or they should know right from wrong. I'm not really sure what that means. Okay, next, you go up to the flood, and after the flood, you have the dispensation of human government. Well, human government is not a moral characteristic. It's a duty. So can you see that the stewardship under Noah is of a different type completely than the previous two dispensations or stewardships? So there's a discontinuity there, do you see? There's a category difference. So if there's a category difference, then do we mean the same thing by stewardship? Or is the stewardship under Noah still a stewardship under conscience, but with something added? That is, they are now to form governments to punish evildoers. Again, not very much in there, is there? Well, then we get up to the patriarchal times, the supposed dispensation of promise. But a promise is not anything like executing government, and it's not anything like a moral quality like innocence or conscience. A promise is, in that context, a covenantal obligation that God has placed himself under to a particular people. Straight away, you see a number of differences there. So are they to continue using their consciences and forming human governments in the same way as before? They just have a promise now, or certain of them do. If that's the case, then you see the dispensation hasn't really changed, at least ethically. But further, the promise is only made to Abraham and his seed, whereas the other dispensations, the whole of humanity are under it. Again, are we talking about the same animal here? Then we move into law, which is given to Israel, and the Mosaic covenant, which only Israel are placed under. Well, because they're under law, Does that abrogate the fact that they are to use their conscience? Does that do away with human government? Does it do away with promise? No, all of these three things are wrapped up together and involved in law, but again, restricted to Israel. And whereas law reminds us again of human government, the law was more than human government. In fact, the whole of the law is really the way that we should be toward God and towards each other. But then we come to the Gospel Age, the age of the church. If we call it the age of grace, then there's a confusion, because there was certainly grace before that. And I understand what John 1 says, that the law was until Moses and grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. But grace there is being used in a particular sense, probably in regards to the new covenant that Christ brings. Remember, John is writing looking back at the ministry of Christ. And the prologue is describing the whole meaning and significance of Christ's first coming and his resurrection and ascension. So grace in John 1 isn't just a reference to the Pauline gospel. That's doubtful anyway. So you can't use John 1:14 and John 1:17 and characterize yourself by the dispensation of grace, unless you are willing to say it's a dispensation of the coming of Christ or the dispensation of the new covenant or something like that. But which dispensationalist goes there? Grace, again, is a gift of God. It's not even like promise. A promise, which, by the way, is not the best designation because it is a covenant, and a covenant is different than a promise. But a promise is something that God has said that he's going to do. Grace is something that God does. And if we say it's a dispensation of the church, then we are changing reference again, changing the categories. Now we're saying it's a dispensation of a particular people. But we didn't say that when we talked about the dispensation of the law. We didn't say it was the dispensation of Israel. Further, most dispensationalists, of course, believe that there is going to be a removal of the church before the 7-year tribulation. But they don't believe that the tribulation is a dispensation. Why on earth not? Don't people have a stewardship that they are under in the tribulation that differs from the church and differs from the millennium that comes after it? And of course, the tribulation would be describing the turmoil of the times. And then the millennial reign comes next, of course. That's usually the 7th dispensation. And the millennium is Christ's reign on earth, his 1,000-year reign in the future. That's the only dispensation where we know how long it is beforehand. And, of course, millennium just means 1,000 years. So the 1,000-year reign of Christ. Well, if it's the 1,000-year reign of Christ, who's the steward of the millennial dispensation? Surely it's Christ. And of course, one of the things that dispensationalists have traditionally done is that they have liked to say that every dispensation ends in failure. Well, of course, if Christ is the steward of the 7th or 8th dispensation, then it surely doesn't end in failure. It does end in rebellion, but not the rebellion of the steward. So I hope you can see, dispensationalism is not really a system. Dispensationalism, because it defines itself by dispensations, limits itself to describing certain things, stewardships, which don't really say very much. And that constricting definition confines dispensationalism to just saying a few things in a few areas of systematic theology, and not saying hardly anything about anything else. In other words, you can't use dispensational theology to create an apologetic or a biblical worldview, or a system of biblical counseling, for example. It really is very self-limiting. And in the area of biblical theology, well, the dispensations are so higgledy-piggledy and really so open to question about what they actually are and how many of them there are and so on, that they're of no real use. So why would you define yourself by dispensations? Now, you say, well, do you believe there are dispensations? Yes, I do believe there are dispensations. But I don't think that they are of any use for building either a biblical theology or a systematic theology. And I think I've demonstrated why that's the case. Now, you can retain all of the great things about dispensational theology, particularly its plain sense, grammatical, historical, hermeneutic, and its Israel-church distinction, and all of these other things, if you concentrate on the biblical covenants. You say, well, I've heard dispensationalists do that. Maybe you have. But how come that's not in their definitions of themselves? How come in Charles Ryrie's article on dispensationalism in the Dictionary of Premillennial Theology, he never mentions the covenants? Surely, you would think in an article of several pages, if the covenants were that crucial and fundamental to dispensational theology, they'd be mentioned in the article. But you see, they're not. Because dispensationalists are looking in the wrong place. They're looking at dispensations. They should stop looking at the dispensations and get their eyes on the biblical covenants and define themselves by the biblical covenants. That's what I try to do. That's what I call, for want of a better term, biblical covenantalism.